Court. We have two cases today. First one is United States v. Moore. Because this is a TJAG certified case, the government will argue first. So, Colonel Talcott, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? And Major Crouch, are you prepared to argue on behalf of Appellee? Very well then, please proceed.
May it please the Court, I am Colonel Matthew Talcott, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States Air Force. Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honors, in this case, the government's going to ask that this Court remand the CCA's decision to the lower court so they can reaccomplish their factual sufficiency review in accordance with the correct legal principles. Despite acknowledging that the victim in this case awoke, felt the accused penetrating her, physically pushed him off, and said, "What the F are you doing?" The lower court found that there was no evidence that the victim was without consent at a period of time when she was capable of consenting. This was legal error in their factual sufficiency review and their legal sufficiency review and demands a remand. There is no easy way to reconcile the lower court's decision with this court's recent decision in Casillas under very similar facts, and that is why we will ask this court to remand.
Colonel Talcott, before you proceed, I'd like to ask you to address Appellee's challenge to this court's jurisdiction in this case. Needless to say, jurisdiction is a huge deal. This court has to satisfy itself that it has jurisdiction before it can proceed to the issues before it. And here, Congress placed in a jurisdictional provision this requirement of appropriate notification of the certified case. There's nothing in the record before us that indicates that that notification has occurred. So why isn't this a war stopper in terms of this court exercising jurisdiction here?
You're under two answers. The first is the government is entitled to presumptions of regularity in the accordance of business. That is, there's no reason you would presume the proper notifications were not made. The government in our briefs has made assurances that the notifications were made, and there's no evidence they were not made. And for this court to assume the opposite, I think, would be a misstep in their jurisdiction analysis. Secondly, this court, and I'm blanking on the name of the order, addressed this issue already by issuing a summary disposition order published that said the government doesn't have to affirmatively provide evidence, and we were proceeding upon this court's jurisprudence in not providing that evidence. So I don't think there's a jurisdictional issue here for at least those two reasons. And I think in rebuttal I'll be able to provide that case name. I'm certain Ms. Payne knows the case. I'm right now blanking on it. My apologies, Your Honors. Moving to the issue regarding factual and legal sufficiency, I'd like to point out here that there really isn't any due process concerns in this case. One of the key reasons here is there's no issue about whether the instructions were properly provided. The members were instructed on the proper elements. There were only two elements, and the elements are without consent and penetration. What makes this case even different and much stronger than perhaps the decision in Mendoza is there is no consent at all an issue in a sleeping case. That is, there's no possibility the members could have been confused. Are we convicting him of a sleeping case or a without consent case? Because the elements don't have anything to do with sleep. Whereas in Mendoza, the elements are incapable of consenting must be proved. So consent is all bound up in that. So in this case, it's much stronger than what this court was facing in Mendoza because the elements are very straightforward, without consent, penetration, where a sleeping case wouldn't have anything to do with consent. Secondly, I'd say after this court's decision in Mendoza, there's no longer any due process concerns so long as the conviction is not merely based on the evidence of incapacity. And in this case, it appears that the CCA got it backwards. They read Mendoza as saying the opposite. That is, if the government uses any evidence at all from a period of time of incapacity, then the government can't move forward on a without consent case, and we'll find there is no evidence. I mean, this court was saying the direct opposite, which was, no, you still have to consider all the surrounding circumstances. In fact, in Mendoza, the court explicitly said you must consider the intoxication evidence in a case of incapacity. There were concerns with due process because of the CCA's analysis, and it seemed like they were affirming the conviction only based on incapacity, which would be improper. The other thing I'd like this court to consider clarifying in this decision, it's an open question, I think, from Casillas, is the CCA's, is some of the decisions we've cited in our citations to supplemental authorities, is when this court is instructing the CCAs to do their factual and legal sufficiency analysis, are they asking them to do a snapshot analysis, or did they really mean what they said when they said you must consider all of the surrounding circumstances? And what I mean by that is it does appear that some of the CCAs believe that the victim must have a capacity to consent, without consent, and penetration all at that exact same second. Like we snap a chalk line and a snapshot in time, and you can't consider any other evidence. That, I think, would be improper and be against the instruction, Article 120G7, that, of course, the CCAs could look at evidence before and evidence after. And this court's hypothetical in Casillas, I think, highlighted that point. One of the judges asked, imagine a wife. I'm going to flip this hypothetical and go on both sides of it just to illustrate this point fully. But what if a wife were to say to her husband, and I'm simplifying it here just slightly, were to say to her husband, I'm about to go to sleep, but while I'm asleep, I'm okay with you having sexual intercourse with me. The court asked the U.S. Air Force or the government, could you proceed on a without consent theory in that case? And the government said, no, of course not. There was an agreement to the sexual contact at issue that was sexual intercourse while they were sleeping. While the instruction says you cannot consent, it doesn't say does not consent. It just means the agreement doesn't change during sleep. To flip the hypo drives home the other point, which is, if the wife had said, I'm about to go to sleep, you better not have sex with me tonight. The one thing I don't want is sex from you. She sleeps all night, awakes in the morning, and her husband says, last night, I know you didn't want me to have sex with you, but I did. Surely this court did not mean to suggest under those facts that would not be without consent. The evidence before, at a period of time, were capable of consenting. The victim clearly indicated they did not consent. And that agreement, or that lack of agreement, did not go away when she went to sleep. In fact, that's why Article 120G7, the instruction on consent, says a sleeping person cannot consent. It answers the question about what to do with gaps in memory. Some of the CCAs have called these the gray area cases. I'm talking now about some of the CCA judges in the Coe decision, but there's some hinting at it also in the Grafton decision, which we cited to this court. What to do in a case where there is a gap in the memory of the victim, where
counsel,
we don't know.
We've gone pretty far afield from this case. So you want a remand here, and from both legal and factual sufficiency. And legal sufficiency is one thing. Factual sufficiency is a different thing, because we need to justify that, we need to believe that they were mistaken about the law or they misunderstood the law. And, of course, they didn't have the benefit of Casillas when they wrote their opinion. So how would the government like us, if we were to do that, to remand for new legal, but let's focus on factual sufficiency, how would you like us to explain to the CCA what did they misunderstand when they decided their decision the first time?
I think there are two things the court could clarify, and a third that I was, with regard to the snapshot, I think would be helpful, and I'll get to that one last. But the first two I think that are simple are, this court never meant to suggest you shouldn't consider all of the surrounding circumstance. This court was not suggesting that Article 120G7C was unconstitutional or couldn't be considered, and it was your obligation to consider all the circumstances. And so when the CCA said there is no evidence of without consent at a period of time when there's capacity to consent, that was a legal error, and it invalidated their legal sufficiency analysis and factual sufficiency analysis. A second way to think about that, if you look at the other Air Force Court CCA decisions we've cited to, they all seem to imply that the government, if it proceeds forward on a without consent case, sort of automatically loses if there's any period of time where there's incapacity, whether it's through alcohol or sleep. The CCA is sort of saying, well, look, the government proceeded on this other theory, so there's no evidence of a without consent in a period of time when there's capacity. That's error, I think, and this court could clarify that. That if the government can go forward on a without consent case, even if there is brief periods of time where the victim is without capacity. And that's why I think this discussion that I brought up regarding the snapshot in time is important. Because in Casillas, I think the CCAs may be mistakenly thinking the only portion of that sex assault that he could be held accountable for is the sex assault after the victim woke up. Well, if the members believed the victim was without consent at the moment she fell asleep, nothing changed while she was asleep, and he should have been held fully accountable for the entire sex assault. And although this court didn't have to reach that issue to find legal sufficiency, it just had to find, you know, any rational trier of fact could have found beyond a reasonable doubt. But the CCAs may not realize that this court did intend for the CCAs to consider all the surrounding circumstances. I think that clarification would be helpful, although, as you pointed out, Judge Hardy, not necessary to resolve this case. You could simply say, you know, please remand in accordance with our decision in the United States against Casillas, which they didn't have the benefit of, which would control, I think, in this case. The facts are so similar.
Counsel, before you, did you hit your third point?
I did, Your Honor.
Okay. Because I want to circle back, and it's a follow-on in many ways to Judge Hardy, because as I see that, as you cited in this whole line of cases, this raft of cases that we have before us, the two issues that seem to be the problem areas is that surrounding circumstances. And in light of that, this is how I'll phrase it, in light of that, how far or how broad can the government go in presenting evidence or argument of surrounding circumstances without bumping into or without changing theories, which was the problem in Mendoza?
I think there are two answers. And the first is from Mendoza. You know, so long as the government isn't trying to obtain a conviction solely by reliance on the period of incapacity. For example, if trial counsel would have said in this case, we know there's a question about whether the victim's lying. We know that, you know, she let him lay in her lap and that it seems like maybe she was interested in him. You don't have to resolve that. Don't even worry about whether there was consent or not consent prior to when she sleep. You can ignore all that evidence. You don't even have to consider it because she was asleep. And if she's asleep, that proves she didn't consent. That's improper after Mendoza. And I think it always was improper. That would be a violation of considering all the surrounding circumstances. The second one, I think, is, I've actually forgotten it, Your Honor. There are two reasons. The first is the decision in Mendoza. The second is, I think the rule already sort of instructs on this. And so what I mean by that is, and this, I guess, goes back to the gray area cases. In the gray area cases, because there's a gap in the memory, Congress gave us Article 120, G7B, to help the members resolve that. You know, one of the things I think that is powerful when you think about the way that consent instruction works is it's given only in sleep cases. I'm overstating that. It is not given in sleep cases, even though the instruction says a sleeping person cannot consent. In fact, that part of the instruction is given in consent cases. So Congress specifically wanted the members thinking about how would sleep affect a without consent case. And they wanted the members to know that during sleep, a person cannot consent. And the way this plays out in trials is there's a lot of evidence the victim was not consenting. And either because she's drugged, or she's had so much alcohol, or she's asleep, she can't remember what happens. When she awakens, she learns someone's had sex with her. Now, in that fact scenario, the government can't go forward on a sleeping theory. We don't know if she's sleeping. She might have been incapacitated from alcohol. We can't go forward on alcohol because it might have been drugs. And we can't go forward on drugs because it might be the other two. But we can potentially go forward on without consent because we prove before the block in memory that she was without consent. We point to Article 120 G7B and say, look, when she's incapacitated, when she's asleep, whatever you resolve, what's happening in that moment, it didn't change. During that period, she couldn't possibly have consented. And that is powerful. In fact, if the government isn't allowed to use the instruction that Congress drafted for that purpose, there's an entire class of cases that are going to be extremely difficult or impossible for the government to move forward on. Alcohol, intoxication, and sleep, as this court is now well aware, was always well aware, are very common scenarios and situations in which predators will prey upon victims in that moment of weakness, and they need an instruction to let them know what's happening during that sleep. I'll drill home on this a little more just by referring back to this court's question in Casillas about the wife. And this is just to highlight the differences between without consent theory and the sleeping theory. In the situation with the wife, who forms an agreement with the accused to have sex while she's asleep, that agreement continues during her sleep. A sleeping person can't consent, but it doesn't say a sleeping person doesn't consent. And she had agreed to the sexual conduct at issue, which was sex during sleep. Now, if the government had charged a sleeping or an incapacity theory, consent doesn't matter. We don't care about that agreement. We just need to prove she's asleep and the accused knew or reasonably known. Much easier case to prove. In fact, it is a case we could prove where the other one we couldn't. And that's an important distinction between the two and a valuable one in that it governs the way the government would charge cases. I will say, before I sit down, consent was an issue in this case. The government elicited testimony that between himself and the victim, there was never anything romantic. There was no flirting. The appellee never made an advance. The victim never consented. That the victim woke, realized there was penetration, pushed him off, and said, "What the F are you doing?" The accused, upon seeing her wake up and being confronted with her saying, "What the F are you doing?" said, "You're right, you're right," which sounds extremely incriminating. It's an admission of his wrongdoing. It doesn't make any sense if they had formed an agreement for him to have sex, to penetrate her vagina with his fingers while she was sleeping. Presumably, if they had formed that agreement that continued through her sleep, when she woke up and said, "What the F are you doing?" he would have said, "What we talked about, what we had an agreement to do, what you had consented to." But because consent was the issue, he said, "You're right, you're right." If the government was proceeding on a sleeping theory, eliciting all of that evidence seems strange. In fact, it seems ridiculous. The government wouldn't have needed to if they truly were proceeding on a sleep theory. They wouldn't have elicited all this evidence about consent. It doesn't matter. It's not an element. But because they were, and that was their theory, they explicitly elicited all this testimony. Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. There are no questions. Thank you.
Any questions from the bench? Thank you, Colonel Talcott. Major Crouch.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Megan Crouch, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Marinos, we represent Airman Nicholas Moore. The Air Force Court correctly applied Mendoza and did not err as a matter of law in its factual sufficiency determination. This court should affirm the lower court's decision. This court accepts a lower court's action to disapprove findings unless the lower court acted without regard to a legal standard.
Counsel, are you no longer pursuing your challenge to the jurisdiction of this court?
Your Honor, we are pursuing that challenge. Airman Moore still challenges whether this court has jurisdiction to hear the case. The case that you had, that the government had mentioned, was Downham about, and the question you had asked about the appropriate notification. And I would draw the court's attention to the fact that in that case, the notification and the certification did state that appropriate notification had been made to the other services. So that's different in, compared to this case, because the certification in this case did not state that appropriate notification had been made. So just as a clarifying point for that.
So let's pursue that a little bit, because as I said, when it comes to jurisdiction, that is extraordinarily important. Can't move forward unless this court has satisfied itself that it does have jurisdiction. In a recent Supreme Court case, Beckler versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue, the Supreme Court said that a rule is jurisdictional only if Congress makes it clear that it was intended to be jurisdictional. Now, obviously, Congress took this notification requirement, put it into a jurisdictional provision. But is there anything else you can point to that would cause this court to say Congress was clear in indicating that it intended for this to be a jurisdictional requirement?
No, Your Honor, there's nothing that I found that would say that that would make it any more clear than what's already in the statute, and understanding that all of those words are important to understanding whether this court has jurisdiction. Certainly that Article 67 guides the way that this court can act and the matters that it can act on. And so understanding that how cases can reach this court, the statute is clear that appropriate notification must be made to the other services before this case, before the court can hear this case.
But if we look at that in terms of jurisdiction and the importance of that, one might expect that Congress, in indicating clearly that it was intended to be jurisdictional, that there would be some specificity in regard to what the government needed to do. Here, there's no indication of any timeline of when it needs to be done, no indication of whether it needs to be in writing or whether it can be done orally, no indication of what the language needs to be. Is it simply a notification that I, as TJAG of whatever service, will be certifying this case, or does it have to be notification about what the issue is? There's no requirement for acknowledgement of receipt. Why shouldn't this court look at this and say that this is so amorphous that we can't determine whether, in fact, Congress clearly intended for this to be jurisdictional?
Your Honor, at a minimum, appropriate notification has to be made. I hear the concerns around that it doesn't say whether it has to be done orally or in writing, how it's made, who it's made to, although it does say it has to be made to the other judge advocate general of the other services. It does at least have to be made. And it's a simple thing that the government could turn over and produce, and the government hasn't. And so understanding that this court must satisfy itself of jurisdiction and it has an independent duty to determine whether it has jurisdiction, that's a simple piece that the government could turn over that information. Certainly did in Downham by just stating that in the certification. That's what I say about that, Your Honor. If this court decides to go forward and believes it does have jurisdiction in this issue and regarding this matter, the lower court did not err as a matter of law in its factual sufficiency determination. The lower court correctly interpreted and implied Mendoza. It stated in its opinion, it described its responsibilities under Article 66, and it explained what the government had to prove in this case. It also explained the definition for consent and stated in its opinion that it must or that it can consider all surrounding circumstances when determining whether a person consented. So the court knew it had to consider all the circumstances when evaluating consent, and it did in this case.
But, counsel, I don't want to throw you off, but and this is similar to the question that I posed to the government. So in Moore, and you say that the court considered all surrounding circumstances, but yet it said there was no evidence to support that government had proved the element of capable of consent, where in this case in particular, you have a physical manifestation of non-consent. So my question goes back to then, when we say surrounding circumstances, are they cabined? Or as government said, is there a snapshot wherein everything must align? Or is it more like res gestae that it's the events surrounding the actual actus reus?
Your Honor, I think every case is going to be different. I think it is all surrounding circumstances. And in this case, particularly, the Air Force Court considered, I mean, they spent 4 pages detailing what the facts were of this case. So they talked about what his testimony was. They spent about 2 pages detailing his testimony. They knew what she testified to. And then they spent 2 pages detailing other witness testimony. So they knew what the other witnesses testified to. And when they got to the analysis piece of their opinion, which is fairly short, they said that they did give appropriate deference to the fact finder, and then they were not convinced. So in this case, what they're saying is that looking at their entire opinion as a whole, they were not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Airman Moore was guilty. They considered all of the evidence, and in their factual sufficiency review, which they have significant discretion in that review, they were not convinced that a non-consensual sexual act occurred at the time that it may have been capable of consenting. And that's what the government had to prove. They had to prove that it was capable of consenting and did not consent. And in doing its factual sufficiency review, Air Force Court evaluated the inconsistent statements about what happened, specifically that testified that she may have had a conversation while she was falling asleep or half asleep. That's something that the Air Force Court could consider along with her other testimony. The Air Force Court also considered that three witnesses testified to information about what he told them that was inconsistent with what he had testified. And so the Air Force Court evaluated all of the evidence, gave it the appropriate weight, gave appropriate deference to the fact finder, and then ultimately concluded it was clearly convinced the findings were against the weight of the evidence.
Counsel, what would we look to in the opinion that we could satisfy ourselves that this is distinguishable from Casillas? So how what would we look to? What did they say that would convince us that there was no time at which the appellee was committing a sexual act upon the victim when she was capable of consenting but did not consent? Because that's really what we came down to in Casillas. I understand all your points about they litigated one case but charged it different and the due process concerns, and that's all very compelling, but that was all very compelling in Casillas too. So what distinguishes this case from Casillas? Or what could we point to in the CCA's opinion? What findings of fact or statements did they make that draws it out of the Casillas zone?
Yes, Your Honor. What I would point to, understanding that their statement regarding their factual sufficiency review is on JA-10, and what they say is, for these reasons, we conclude appellant's conviction for sexual assault. It's the next sentence. Additionally, for the same reasons, after giving the appropriate deference to the fact finder, they state why that they're clearly convinced. So understanding that that's what we have for the analysis, what you can look to is at JA-6, where there are three different witnesses that the Air Force Court highlights that testified to information that was inconsistent with what had testified to. And in doing their factual sufficiency review, they get to consider that and consider what the weight is to give those witnesses and how does that play out with his testimony. There was one witness who stated that he had told her that Airman Moore was trying to put it in, that doesn't really describe what he had described. Another witness who says that Airman Moore was on top of her, but doesn't say that there was any penetration that was occurring. And then a third witness who says that he told him that someone was touching her and trying to do more. So again, those are inconsistent in terms of what exactly might have been happening. And so we know that the Air Force Court considered that testimony, and that's different in my understanding of looking at not only this court's opinion in Casillas, but the Air Force Court's opinion, is that in Casillas, the victim in that case woke up and there was a sexual assault occurring and said, like, I did not consent in that moment. That moment, I was awake and I did not consent. And in this case, there's no testimony from that in that moment she was not consenting. Now, I recognize, Jen Johnson, you did point out there was her pushing Airman Moore off, or what she testifies to is pushing Airman Moore off. And so that could be considered as a demonstration of lack of consent. But there's also testimony that where she said that she may have had a conversation when she was half asleep, and the Air Force Court could have considered that there may have been some kind of mistake of fact for Airman Moore. So it's different from Casillas in that sense, that there's inconsistent testimony, there's less robust and conflicting evidence regarding what happened in those moments after he woke up. Another thing that this court can look to in terms of evaluating whether the Air Force Court apply the correct legal principles is looking at the government's presentation of its case and understanding that this doesn't mean, the argument of the case is not evidence, certainly, and when we're doing legal and factual sufficiency, that doesn't necessarily weigh in, but it's important to understand that the government's findings argument, did not touch on the moments when it woke up. And so if the government itself or the prosecution itself in its findings argument wasn't focused on those moments, then it demonstrates that there was a weakness in the case, that they were not even asking the panel members to convict on those moments when he allegedly woke up and there may have allegedly been some kind of sexual assault happening. And so if the government didn't find that to be important in its argument, its findings argument, then why would the Air Force Corps find it to be important?
Counsel, you just said that arguments are not evidence. Why would the CCAs be bound to what the counsel argued at trial, if the record gives a fuller explanation in its view, in the CCA's view?
Your Honor, they're not bound by that, and that's not what I was trying to say, and I apologize if that's how it came across. What I was trying to highlight is that if the government in its argument didn't think that was an important point to focus on in its findings argument, the moments when we woke up, then it demonstrates that even the government and the prosecution didn't find that evidence compelling. So much so that by the time they got to their findings argument, they're not highlighting it. They're not bringing it up for the panel members to consider in finding Airman Moore guilty. So it demonstrates that there was a conflict of evidence there, that the government didn't find it compelling. And so it makes sense why the Air Force Court, in looking at the totality of the circumstances and the entire record, why the Air Force Court also wouldn't find it compelling. It's not to say they're bound by it by any means, but it highlights that there was a weakness in this case. And so when the Air Force Court considered all of the evidence, applied the legal principles from Mendoza to this case, it found that it wasn't convinced beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, Major Crouch, let me ask you this. Now, this same court, this same CCA, issued this U.S. v. Boren, B-O-R-E-N, opinion. And for the life of me, and it could be me, you know, it could be me, when I read these two cases, I'm kind of confused as to why one comes out one way and the other one comes out the other way. It's the same court, a relatively similar factual pattern. I don't know if you're as familiar with Boren, but can you help me out here?
Your Honor, what I would say about that is that my understanding of Boren is that there is not the same kind of inconsistent testimony about what occurred after, in this case, after he woke up. There's the inconsistent testimony, and then in Boren, I'm not tracking the same kind of inconsistent or conflicting evidence. Even if that were the case, you could have three different CCAs look at the same facts, and they're doing their own independent determination. And so three different CCAs.
Well, this is the same CCA.
Yes, Your Honor, but there are different facts. Boren is different than this case, and the nuances of those fact patterns are different. And so the court still could come to a different conclusion in this case compared to Boren, as it could to other cases that are before this court. I believe that this court is going to hear in the next couple days. So the facts matter, and in this case, there was conflicting evidence. The court evaluated it. It used its discretion that it has under Article 66 and was not convinced. Even after applying all the law to all of the facts, it was not convinced in this case. And so because they apply the correct legal principles, a remand isn't necessary. It's not necessary in this case because the court did not err as a matter of law.
Counsel, could you please address the government's discussion of the gray area. And what I understood that to mean is there was a period when the victim was awake and did not consent, and then the victim is asleep or drunk and cannot consent. And the theory is not that there was sex with somebody who was incapable of consenting. The theory is that if there was no consent before they fell asleep, there's no consent afterwards because you can't consent while you're asleep. And that this is not a theory of changing the theory. The theory is still without consent. It's just that if you look at the timeline, while the person's awake, they didn't consent, and then while they're asleep, nothing can change. And so it's still without consent. And the point I understood the government to make was you don't take a snapshot right when the act is occurring and say, well, was the person capable of consenting at that particular point. You simply ask, was there consent recognizing that there could be no change in consent while somebody was asleep. I understood that was my understanding of the government's argument. If I'm wrong about that, you clarify that also.
Your Honor, that was also my understanding of the government's argument. And the government still, as this court held in Mendoza, the government still has to prove that the victim is capable of consenting. So there has to still be a time when the victim is capable of consenting and did not consent. And understanding courts are to consider all of this random circumstances regarding lack of consent or whether there was or wasn't consent. But there still has to be a time when the victim is capable of consenting. It wouldn't make sense to say that a victim was awake and she hadn't consented and then she goes to sleep. And because she was capable of consenting and didn't consent beforehand, that when the sexual act occurred, if the victim is asleep the whole time, it wouldn't make sense that that would qualify. So it's the capable of consenting and without consent matters around when the sexual assault occurred in this, in any case. And then in this case, what the Air Force Court is saying in its opinion is we're not convinced. The government didn't put on enough evidence to convince us that there was a moment or many moments where he was capable of consenting, did not consent, and a sexual act.
But individuals exist in a state of non-consent.
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't think I heard it.
Individuals exist in a state of non-consent.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's the fact at the front of any analysis, is that there was no consent. How does that fit into your argument right now?
I guess what I'm getting at is that there still has to be a moment where the victim was capable of consenting. So even though the non-consent has occurred prior to the victim going to sleep, if the sexual act is occurring when the victim is incapable of consenting, then there's no demonstration of the victim being capable of consenting. And that's what this court said in Mendoza, is that the government has to prove that the victim was capable of consenting and did not consent, and a sexual act occurred. So they all go hand in hand. So there may be non-consent previously, but if a sex act is occurring where somebody is asleep, then they are incapable of consenting. Or if they're intoxicated, they are incapable of consenting.
So, counsel, let's go back to Mendoza, because that language that keeps occurring, reoccurring in these cases, that the government must prove that the victim was capable of consenting, and that being tied to what Mendoza held, I would submit that's not what Mendoza held. That language was being used as part of the statutory analysis discussion to distinguish, you know, levels within the subsections of 120. And so that to say, well, the B3A provision specifically talks about being incapable. So therefore, the presumption is that obviously B2A, a victim is capable. But the court was not creating a third element for a B2A offense. I mean, do you agree with that premise, that we were not creating a third element for B2A offense?
Chief Judge Wilson, I think my time has expired.
Please respond to Judge Johnson.
Thank you. Ma'am, yes, I agree, Your Honor. I do agree with that, that the court was not creating a new element of capable consenting. In this case, the Air Force Court considered the law and applied it to the facts and did not apply incorrect legal principles. So the Air Force Court did not err as a matter of law in its factual sufficiency determination.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Major Crouch?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Colonel Tonka.
Your Honor, I'd like to start by discussing or responding to Appellee's discussion of the CCA's factual sufficiency analysis, which it seemed they were trying to characterize as sort of a weighing of credibility and kind of counting inconsistencies, and that this was very much in a factual sufficiency analysis. But if you read the opinion, it was anything but The court made its legal sufficiency determination by saying no rational fact finder could possibly find that there was any evidence, and we find there's no evidence. And their factual sufficiency analysis is like five words for the same reasons. So they knew they were making their factual sufficiency determination based entirely upon a legal matter. It was identical to their legal sufficiency analysis. It was based on a legal error in that they believe they could not consider all the surrounding circumstances. There is no indication it was about weighing credibility, witnesses, or counting inconsistencies, or determining the victim wasn't credible. They simply said there's no evidence.
So,
and
counsel,
said that's the same, Your Honor.
In light of that, then, because that goes back to the CD argument, of what this court can, what its authority is in looking at a factual sufficiency challenge, and that in Citi we said it has to be the incorrect application of legal principles on a matter of law. So you're arguing that, that's where this falls.
Precisely, Your Honor.
Okay.
The second was, point I'd like to respond to, is Apelli's position that the issue of the victim waking up wasn't even part of the closing, so therefore this court should disregard that. Aside from the obvious response that Judge Sparks had, which is, you know, facts aren't evidence, and that, you know, arguments aren't evidence, it's just simply not exactly accurate. They did specifically talk about that moment, and they talked about how the victim said to the accused, "What the F are you doing?" And the accused responded, "You're right, you're right." And what's critical about that moment is the government didn't say, "That proves she's asleep, so we win." The government said, and I'm quoting, "If this was consensual, that doesn't make any sense, because this was a consent case from beginning to end. The instructions, the charging, the crime, the government's theory, and even the defense's strategy." They didn't go in there saying, "We're going to prove she's," they're going to go in there proving she's a liar. She made this up, and she actually was consenting. That was their whole theory. There's nothing even approaching a due process issue in this case. I'd like to also highlight how unworkable Apelli seems to suggest the government should have proceeded on a sleep theory, or at least the CCA seems to suggest we should have proceeded on a sleep theory or mischarged this case. But sleep in this case would have been completely unworkable. I'll note to JA57 where, I see my time is expiring. Your Honor, may I just very quickly finish this point?
Quickly.
Okay. In the case, there was evidence the victim conceded it was possible she was talking when she was asleep, possible she had a conversation while she was asleep, possible she had a conversation and forgot it. How could the government possibly approve with those concessions if the accused reasonably knew she was asleep? Thank you, Your Honor. For those reasons, I ask you to remand.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Colonel Talcott. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
The court stands in recess until 10:30.